Hi and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK Police Force. Thanks for listening. Hopefully you've been listening and following the series. If not, you might want to go back to the beginning. Welcome. Great downloads this week, and we've hit a bit of a milestone for sure. 30,000 downloads in total, which is unbelievable to me. I know I will say this, it probably gets boring, but I cannot believe that 30,000 people have downloaded my podcast to listen to it. So hopefully some people are enjoying it. That could be 30,000 people that just listen to it for a few seconds before they turn it off, of course. But we'll see. We are getting pretty close to the end now. I don't know for sure, but there's maybe only a couple of episodes left, to be honest with you, before we reach the end of my career. And then we'll talk about what we're going to do then. It will come to an end of sorts, but we'll cover that in the future. So this week, and thank you again for somebody else bought me a coffee. Appreciate that. And also there were some comments on YouTube, so I mustn't forget that. We're going to just do some follow-up work on a little bit on what we talked about last week, because I didn't get to sort of fully cover it all. I hope the sound will be all right today. It's very stormy again where I am. I'm hoping there won't be any sort of rainy, stormy wind type background noise, but bear with me. So last week we covered my role, or some of my role, as a CTLO, a counter-terrorist liaison officer in Police Scotland. And I described, hopefully in reasonable detail, sort of what that entailed. I covered most of the roles, but there was a couple of areas that I wanted to talk about that you, again, probably haven't heard of. I know we talked about one or two of those last week, but these also are areas perhaps that are fairly unknown, and one particularly, well, perhaps both, I think, will have you quite surprised at the fact they even exist. And then we'll move on to something else. So the first thing is the term incel. Now, we talked about the fact that I had a lot of dealings within the school in relation to prevent invariably young lads, you know, that were, you know, being bullied and needing a way to protect themselves, so they turned into something else to try and effectively scare the bullies off. This other thing, incel, involuntary celibate, I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's a very, very strange concept to most people. Little bit of sort of unclear where it started, but America, of course, is where it seems to have taken off more so than here, but it's very much based online. So an involuntary celibate is, again, an incel, is again a young lad in 99.9% of cases, ranging from about 14 up to maybe 25 or 30 years old. They're quite often sort of school age, 16, 18, 20, something like that. And basically, they're virgins. And because of that, they basically blame females for all their woes. The fact that women, you know, girls, their peers, don't find them sexually attractive is why they're virgins. And therefore, they feel, in their words, that the pretty girls are kind of holding them back. Now, initially, you think, well, it's a bit of a strange concept, but, you know, that's the end of that. Unfortunately, it's a huge, huge area. So these disaffected young males have taken online to various forums and groups, and it's now a growing movement, unfortunately. I say movement, it's not organised, you know, but it is basically young lads going online and as I say, effectively blaming women for all their woes. You know, it comes from the virginity thing, for sure, and it is definitely sexually based, but it started out, I think, just as people ranting, but unfortunately it's culminated in men actually attacking women, and not always women, as we'll hear, to effectively get back at them for what they feel are all their sort of problems that stems from this virginity and this lack of sexual activity. They perceive these pretty girls, as they call them, as being very sexually active, and therefore sort of holding the incels to ransom by not giving them what they feel is their, you know, their sort of their right, which is sexual activity with anyone they choose, in their eyes, women particularly, well, in fact, only in their eyes. It's a very strange world. It's a massive, massive subject. I had an article when I was at work, a report from a professor in a university who specialised in this, and it was about 200 pages long, because they have an entire sort of language all of their own that they use to discuss things online. So it perhaps wouldn't be obvious to the outside world what they're talking about. A bit of a code, I suppose, but really, really involved subject. Back in 2014, there was a young lad, I think he was 22, called Elliot Rodger in America. And he basically had had enough. He decided of being held to ransom by these pretty girls, and this lack of sexual activity on his part. I think he'd probably been mocked by some girls at school or college, and that had built up this anger within inside him. He basically released a 141-page, kind of document listing why women and girls were at fault for all his issues, and then went on to take physical action. And by that I mean he drove a vehicle into a crowd of these pretty girls. I know it's a saying I keep coming back to, but it's how they refer to women in some cases, or girls. Drove his vehicle into a crowd, got out, and then basically stabbed and shot and killed six young girls at college. He recorded like a message that he put out on YouTube, as well as at the same time he released his sort of his document about why he was doing this. And unfortunately, he obviously kind of sparked a bit of a well, certainly, obviously, he ended up dying in, I think it was a shootout with the police in the end, or maybe took his own life. But he basically sparked a whole movement, and he became known as the Distinguished Gentleman, and he's regularly referred to online as a bit of a sort of godlike figure to incels. It's a really, really unpleasant world, as you can imagine, and very, very derogatory on females for sure. The vast majority just stay online and discuss it online, but I'm afraid some physically tip over into action. And certainly in the UK, there's been a few cases of it as well. There was a guy at Edinburgh who had bizarrely stabbed a police officer in 2017 when I think he was at college, so he was only 16 or 17. And as a result of that, he got put on an order for, I think it was 5 years, where he had to attend to see a psychiatrist every month, I think it was. And he basically slowly let slip to this psychiatrist that he blamed women for all his woes, and that he, very much looked up to the distinguished gentleman, this Elliot Rodger, who'd carried out this attack. And it got to the point the psychiatrist was so concerned about what he was going to do, he reported him to the police. That sort of patient confidentiality had gone out the window because he was really worried he was going to carry out an attack. And sure enough, they stopped him and at his home address, and he was in possession of a crossbow. He'd bought extra bolts. I think he had about 20 crossbow bolts. He had body armor. He had a detailed plan of how he was going to carry out an attack at his university on the pretty girls and get them back for, again, what he saw as all his woes. So it isn't just America. And unfortunately, of course, once again, all this stuff is very easy to look at online. So we've seen youngsters looking at this stuff online, and then they start to refer in to women by these names. Now they have, and it sounds a bit ridiculous, but they have different terminology for different types of women, what they see. So they call them the Stacies. The Stacies in this world are what they believe are the sort of pretty girls, these very sexually active females. That they view are withholding, their right to sex, basically. So they consider them Stacies, and then they have the males that they believe, they're sort of the muscular, very, very manly heterosexual males that are having all this sex with these Stacies. They call them Chads. So we have the Stacies and the Chads having all this sex and basically, kind of not allowing the incels to be part of this world. Then they have what they call the sort of normal women. They call them all sorts of unpleasant things, but they refer to them as Beckies. So you now have, now bear with me, because you're probably sitting here going, what? I can't keep up. This is ridiculous. And this is what I used to think when I gave these talks, but I'm afraid it is. So we've got the Chads and the Stacies having all this sex. We've got the Beckies, who are very plain, very basic girls, although they don't use that term. You can imagine it's far more unpleasant. Then you have normies, as in normal people, normies that are unaffected by this, that are just in a normal couple, they're in a normal loving relationship, they're kind of out of this side of things. And then there's lots of references to the film The Matrix, which becomes even more bizarre because it becomes about what colour pill that you take in life. And I'm not talking about literally, I'm talking about as to basically what you believe in. You know, if you're a blue piller, then you might be a normie because you take a blue pill and you don't believe in any of this sort of incel stuff. If you're a red piller, then you might be somebody who has incel thoughts and tendencies, but you're not actually willing to carry it out or take it any further. You just have those thoughts and maybe spout off online. If you're a black piller, if you take the black pill, you have a very dark view on life. You're full on incel and you're prepared to physically attack women. You know, over what you see as the sort of, you know, the wrongs and the ills of the word against you, all created by women in your eyes. And these, the guys are online, you know, talking in detail about raping women, and they're very forensically aware, and they discuss how they would get away with multiple attacks on women, whether that's sexually by raping them or, you know, physically harming them in some way, driving a vehicle into them, stabbing them, whatever. It's a horrible world, a real massive scene. And again, I used to give these talks to, you know, all the sort of people that I discussed, all the sorts of departments that I discussed in the previous episode. So you would have people sat there kind of open mouthed being, sorry, what? You know, because it's just very hard to get your head round. But sadly true, and definitely a growing trend. So incels, involuntary celibates. So that's a bit of a strange one for you. Now, the other thing we dealt with was modern day slavery. Now, certainly in the UK, you know, it seems very hard to believe, you know, we feel ourselves as presumably a quite a progressive country, you know, that looks after people and takes people's welfare seriously. Modern day slavery exists here in quite a big way, and we found it in our area in various guises. Now, you can get the scenario where someone is trafficked into the country, and that can be for various reasons. So it can be sexually, they're put to work as prostitutes. It can be as domestic slaves, effectively, where you've probably seen the cases where they're literally kept in a shed at the bottom of the garden, or kept in the cupboard under the stairs. You know, they're barely fed, they're barely paid, if at all. They're regularly assaulted and beaten up, or maybe sexually assaulted, depending on the person who's, dare I say the word, looking after them. But they're basically treated horrendously. What we've seen in my area particularly was Ghanaian fishermen that were brought in to work on the fishing boats under the guise that, well, we will look after you, you'll be well paid, you know, and all these sorts of things, all these false promises. And the reality is, when they come into this country, any documents they have, if they came in at all on documents, like the passports, etc., are taken and held from them. So now they feel trapped in the situation, and they're put to work virtually 24 hours a day on the fishing boats. They get assaulted, they barely get fed. You know, it takes all sorts of guises. And we've even seen as well people that are sort of almost like reverse trafficked, where they're forced out of the country to go and have an organ, I won't say donated, but, you know, harvested. So they give up a kidney on the pretense that they're going to, you know, get a large cash payment. And of course, they're told that it's going to be 10,000, 15,000, whatever. The reality is, they're taken out of this country into another country where they find a dodgy surgeon who will remove an organ. Then no payment is forthcoming. They barely get kind of stitched up, you know, aftercare is non-existent. And in a lot of cases, these people end up dying through, you know, infection and poor practices. So it's a horrible scenario as well. We've seen that too in my area. As I say, the operations didn't take here in Scotland. They were sort of trafficked out of the country, but it all started here. So there's a lot more going on than perhaps you'd imagine. So that was just a couple of other elements that I dealt with on the counter-terrorist liaison role. Really vast, ranging, you know, kind of wide subject area, you know, that covered all sorts of weird things, two of those being some of the stranger ones for sure. So while I was going out and giving these talks, I got involved in a lot of exercises, tabletop exercises, and one in particular that I'd organised for a number of different agencies, things like ranging from Coast Guard to council to, you know, roads departments, all sorts. And we set up a sort of tabletop exercise that would mimic a mass terrorist attack, an MTA in the police terms, UK police terms, or an op Plato, as it's called. And this involved, you know, sort of two or three people on the streets going around creating, basically stabbing people. And it might seem far-fetched, but unfortunately we've seen it. London Borough Market was an attack almost word for word like that. And what we wanted to do for our local agencies was, you know, firstly show them what could happen, and secondly show them their role, where they could come in to assist and what role they might play in that. So we went through, you know, sort of it was drip fed in that, you know, you had the initial incident and then it sort of developed on from there. And it was just to give them an idea. And they had various talks from sort of specialists about what their role would be within the police. And they were shown a video. Now, I'd already been asked to get up and give a talk on my experiences on the day on Westminster Bridge on the terrorist attack, which I was okay with. If you have to go back quite a few episodes now, but if you hear about that pretty horrendous attack that I was at, which did affect me a bit afterwards, but this was now some kind of 5, 6 years, 7 years after the attack. So I didn't really have a problem talking about it, and I was quite happy to, you know, sort of cover my experiences. But what they did was they played a video from SO15, which is the Met sort of counter-terrorism unit. And the video was a collection of terrorist attacks from all over the world, really. And it was set to the song The Sound of Silence. So it was very sad. I've seen it before, and it's a real tearjerker for sure. You know, you look around the room, there was about 50-odd people, including like my inspector and various other cops, as well as a lot of these, you know, sort of civilian agencies within the room. You look around the room, it's about a 10-minute video, and there's not a dry eye in the house. You know, it's very, very upsetting video. Now, when the video finished, I was thinking, as long as they now have, you know, a tea break or they deal with some other stuff, and then I get up and do my talk, I'll be absolutely fine. Unfortunately, that's exactly what didn't happen. Almost the second that video finished, and I was already kind of, you know, choking back tears, as most people in the room, they said, right, and now our colleague's going to get up and just talk us through his experiences on Westminster Bridge on the day of the terrorist attack, just to give you an idea of what it's like firsthand to be involved in something like this. So I got up and I felt relatively confident at that point, started talking about my involvement and what I'd done. And I'm afraid it really got to me. And basically, I ended up breaking down in tears in a big blubbery mess on the stage in front of 50 odd people, including, you know, various bosses of mine. Incredibly embarrassing for me. I managed to get through it eventually, but it wasn't pretty. And I felt a really idiot, quite frankly. It hit me very hard. Eventually I was kind of bundled off the stage. I had finished my bit, but through tears, so it was quite a difficult thing. Afterwards, bizarrely, I had various people coming up to me saying, you know, oh, that was really powerful, thanks for telling us about that. I think I felt that a few of them had actually thought that perhaps it had almost been staged, you know, for effect, but I can tell you 100% it wasn't, you know, and it did quite badly affect me at the time. And unfortunately, what it did was it then kind of reignited all the issues I'd had. If you remember going back a good few episodes, it didn't affect me too much at the time, but a year later, when it was all on the news on the anniversaries, when it all came back to haunt me literally, and I struggled for a while then. I didn't really receive any counselling. In fact, I didn't receive any counselling at all at the time. Partly my fault. I probably should have pushed it a bit more, but definitely, you know, the Met's fault in a way. You know, they should have really insisted that I took part in something and that it was dealt with. Anyway, I buried it, as most people do, for these 6 or 7 years. And unfortunately, it literally all came flooding back out at this talk. Of course, my inspector came to see me afterwards and said, you know, clearly this has really affected you and you're not over this. We're going to help you, you know, we're going to get you some counselling, because, you know, the police had moved on a lot in 6 or 7 years. And, you know, that was decided what would happen. Well, it has, to a point anyway, likes to think it has. So I then went down a route of an occupational health kind of referral for some counselling, as did my inspector and I think my sergeant, and they all sort of explored the possibilities and looked at it. Now, it was very much set up for incidents that had just happened, and we had to go all around the houses. It was made really difficult with phone calls and emails to various departments to get passed about, until eventually the final official answer came down, ridiculously, that yes, it's quite a long time ago. We only deal with incidents up to 6 years ago, and that was 7 years ago. So unfortunately, you're out of luck. I mean, have you ever heard anything so ridiculous? It didn't really help it. I mean, I wasn't walking round, you know, like a mess, bursting into tears left, right and centre, but it really affected my sleep again. That's how it seems to come out in me. I just was barely sleeping, and it was very, very difficult time. Anyway, eventually I had to go through an amazing UK charity, Police Care UK, and they are, as I say, a charity, absolutely no funding at all from anyone, but they're set up to help cops and ex-cops basically get access to counselling that they almost certainly should have had at the time of the incident, of things that have affected them. So that was the route that I went down. And I went off to see a really nice counsellor, a woman who I, you know, who helped me a lot. And I had something called EMDR counselling. Now, I'm just trying to look on my phone for the actual wording of it, because I can never remember. It's called Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing, EMDR therapy. Now, you can imagine when I was told that, as a bit of a stick in the mud, I was kind of like, what? You know, I had visions of going into a room and being hooked up to some machine, you know, that's then plugged into the mains, you know, and various electric shocks were put through me or something like that. You know, I had no idea what to expect, really. And I was very skeptical to start with, as I'm sure most people are. But I have to say, it was very, very useful. I'll just briefly talk you through it, and hopefully you won't find it too boring. But basically, the idea is you recount what happened to you, but your eyes are occupied. And because your eyes and your brain is occupied, part of your eyes and brain are kind of off and doing something while you're then talking about this bad thing that happened to you. And rather than it sort of like re-affecting you, you know, and basically putting you back there and sort of causing you all the same issues, because you're dealing with it, but part of your brain is busy, it's a way of going back there and dealing with it and kind of putting the issues to bed, but without full on going back there, if you see what I mean. I've probably not described that very well. And the way your eyes are occupied, there's two ways. One is, and this sounds bizarre, and trust me, when I first did it, I felt a complete idiot. Basically, you tap your hands on your legs in a kind of pattern, almost like a drum beat, on your legs, while you're then talking about incidents and what happened. And although it's not your eyes involved, because you're having to think about that rhythm of tapping your hands up and down while you're talking, that's enough to occupy your brain. The one that I didn't get on so well with, that the one that I did better with, was it's a light bar. It's about 1 or 2 feet long, and it has a single sort of LED light that goes across left to right, or continually one way, so just going left, 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 just this one light that just keeps going left and right, and you have to follow it with your eyes. I think you can do it where you follow like your counsellor's finger as well, as they kind of wave it about in the air. And I know this perhaps sounds a bit ridiculous, but it does work. So the light bar went up in front of me, my eyes focused on this light moving about that I just looked at completely with my eyes and focused on. While I was doing that, I then recounted some of the things that had happened to me and talked through Westminster Bridge, basically. And then every now and then, the counsellor's generally quiet, but every now and then the counsellor would chip in with, okay, and where are you now? Because you're meant to sort of start from the beginning. They would say, give me a beginning point, and you'd see, I was getting off the boat, and I put the first aid pack onto my back, and I walked up the steps at the side of Westminster Bridge, and when I got there, I literally sort of had a sharp intake of breath, because there before me was what I can only describe as a war scene, you know, with bodies everywhere and, you know, vehicles and screaming and, you know, so that's kind of where it started. So I would always start from that same place. I would tell her that, right, here I am, this is where I'm starting. And then I wouldn't verbalize it. I would just think about it. Think of the images I saw on that day while I was watching this light go back and forward. And yes, that's how it's meant to work. You know, your eyes and half your brain's occupied on the light and focusing on that, and not perhaps fully thinking about all those images. But because you're going back and dealing with those images, but you're only sort of half concentrating on them, you're kind of, I don't know, putting them to bed. Is that the right term? I don't know. I've probably done a terrible, terrible job of explaining what is involved. But certainly go and have a look at EMDR therapy if you've got any interest. And certainly if you have had any sort of trauma, I would recommend it. I think I went for one session every week, roughly. There was a few breaks. I had about a dozen sessions. And in fact, what happened was we dealt with Westminster fairly early on in about two or three sessions. So then I was asked by the counsellor, well, is there anything else that kind of comes back to haunt you? And of course, as you've heard in these other episodes, for me, there was probably another half a dozen incidents. You know, there was various fatalities that I dealt with, which were very unpleasant that I always remember. There was my near-death experience off the Kent coast when I was diving, when I got trapped on the wreck, you know, trying to recover that body. So there was probably about another half a dozen incidents or so that I then did the same sort of thing with and recounted, you know, incidents and images whilst watching the light box. You know, and the actual light box side of it might only last for 5 minutes, 10 minutes out of the hour. And then you would, you know, just have a general sort of social chat before and after, or certainly that's what we did. And I never really felt, I never walked out there and felt, oh, I feel so much better. Oh, that's really worked. So again, the skeptic in me was kind of like, this is ridiculous. I'm going in with this strange woman, looking at this flashy light and talking about things that are, you know, huge for me, quite difficult to talk about in some respects. And I know, listen to the podcast, you probably can't believe that anything is difficult to talk about for me because I do like to talk. But it was, you know, and I say, probably, you know, six, maybe eight sessions in, I was thinking this is utter rubbish, you know. But what I can tell you happened was there was no switch that was flicked. I wasn't, you know, instantly fixed, but slowly my sleeping started to get better. And, you know, and I actually realized that it was working. The other thing that really helped me, because I had no problems getting to sleep, I would always sleep instantly in, you know, seconds. But my issue was I'd wake up in the night. And then I'd wake up in the early hours and then my brain would be on overtime, you know, just going through everything. And not necessarily Westminster, it might just be what's happened that day or what I'm doing, you know, in the following week. But I just could not force my brain to relax and empty itself of stuff enough to let me go back to sleep. So I was ending up staying awake all night. And slowly, definitely, the counselling, the EMDR counselling helped me with that. And the other thing that helped was I found an app online, and there's quite a few apps out there, and I'm not advertising them because I think you do have to pay for some of them. But I picked one in particular, and if you want me to, I'll tell you which one it is. But it basically is various narrators, sometimes with quite interesting voices, and you can pick one you like, male and female. You can get the male with a big gravelly voice, you can get the soft female voice, whatever voice you like, and they just talk about all sorts of things, really. So they might talk about, you know, a train that goes up through the snow. They might talk about, you know, a desert or walking through a forest or whatever. And they go on about half an hour or so, but they're very, very detailed. And they talk about, you know, every little bit of, you know, the crunching sound of your feet on the snow. And what, again, happened a bit like the EMDR, I think, is because your brain is semi-listening to these things and what the person is saying, for me, it kind of shuts out all the background noise that's stopping me from sleeping. So with a set of headphones on, my wife would be happy to sleep next to me and unaware, and I would just drift off to sleep again. And I found that really useful as well. So if you are struggling to sleep or whatever, and you're wondering, where has this gone? This is Police Stories Podcast, but this was a big part of my, you know, my last few years in the police, brought about by the things that I'd been involved with and perhaps not dealt with properly. Partly my fault, as I say, partly the job's fault for sure. Maybe I've gone into too much detail. I don't know. I've very much bared my soul to you there about what was happening to me. But Yeah, so therapy and EMDR stuff, yeah, for me, very good, very important, and really, really helped me. And certainly those sleepy type apps were very useful as well. And what's the word normal? I'd hate to say I'm normal now, because what is normal? Most people that know me would say I'm anything but normal, but especially my wife. But yeah, it did work for me. So anyway, that's definitely enough ramblings for this week, coming up on half an hour. Thanks very much for listening. Next week we'll be on to a couple more things for sure. That's definitely the end of that little segment. And as I say, I think there's probably two episodes left, which is a bit of a shame because I have enjoyed this. But let me know your thoughts anyway. You can do that generally kind of through YouTube, or there's various ways you can do it. Have a good week. Hope you found it interesting. Take it easy. Cheers.